Adam Bly continues with us this evening. Adam works with the Roman Catholic Church in exorcism and religious demonology, as well as an auxiliary member of the International Association of Exorcists. We're talking in this next hour about demonic encounters, demons, possession, oppression, and the like. We'll open up phone lines in hour four. If you've had any of these experiences or questions for our guest, that will be the time to direct them to him. We've got a very interesting hour to share with you. I'm not here for fear mongering, as I know Adam is not as well, but we will be sharing insights, thoughts, and concerns, ways that you can protect yourself and watch out for involvement in the dark. So please stay tuned. We've got so much to cover. We've got a lot of great information. And remember, if you'd like more about our guest and you'd like to read his book, you can find Possession, Exorcism, and Hauntings at Amazon.com. We have a link to that up at Coast to Coast AM, or you can visit Adam's direct website at religiousdemonology.com. Stay tuned. More Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest this evening, Adam Bly. I'm your host. My name is Dave Schrader. Adam, there is, of course, if we are to believe the TV shows and the glut of reality shows that are out there, a demon in every cupboard waiting to jump out and attach itself to us, overtake our lives, and drive us into the ground. However, we start hearing more and more about cases like the Vatican amping up exorcism courses and classes, educating more and more exorcists across the United States and around the world to prepare and deal with this. As a matter of fact, there's footage last year, I believe it was, of the Pope performing what appeared to be an exorcism right in the square during his visits. Is there an uprise and an uptick, in your opinion, of evil? Is this going on, or is it just covered more now because of the advent of social media and how quickly the news can spread?
Well, Dave, it's really hard to say for sure. It's a great question. I would say that it does seem that there is an increase in cases, because we are seeing, at least in the United States, that the bishops are responding to the need, and even having a special session on exorcism at their national conference a few years ago for the first time. So, and all of that's in response to genuine cases coming forward after many, you know, decades of, you know, there'd be some cases, but most of them were mental illness. And now, for some reason, we're just seeing a lot more on the possession side of things. Now, of course, the house cases are much more common. Possession is a very rare thing, and people don't need to be overly afraid of that. And we can explain why. You know, it's a controlled thing. It's not a random event that happens to people. But basically, I would say, yes, it does seem that there's more, but you want to really control that causing fear in people, because every generation thinks that their generation is experiencing an extraordinary amount of evil or difficulty in the world. I think that it's very possible that we're just paying more attention to these things right now. And why exactly that is, I'm not sure. It's possible that there's more cases. It's possible that we're just looking at it more. Just like if you look in the regular world, you know, ADHD, you didn't hear about that the whole time we were kids, right? And then, you know, all of a sudden, everybody's got ADHD, and all these, you know, every kid needs medicine for it. And it's more about how we're looking at things in each generation.
Dealing with the demonic realm and those forces, is it also, I know you said it's very rare to actually see full-on cases of possession, mm-hmm. but, you know, with that said, should we still be cautious? Is it something that can happen very easily, and is there anyone that is above having that happen to them?
No, there's nobody above that. You know, some people have an idea that, you know, once you're baptized, it's impossible that you can become possessed. That's just not the case. It's not something that we need to fear as like a random event, like I'll come down with a cold. It's something to understand that possession is basically an extremely deep relationship with a demon. And so the devil, the demons, con us initially, like a con artist would, into some level of relationship with them. And then over time, they want that to deepen. And then eventually, they will often, but not always, want complete control of the body where they basically take over. So it's usually at the end of a multi-year process of a deepening relationship with lots of signs and indications that this is bad and destructive and it's destroying the person's life and they have lots of opportunities to turn back before they get to that point. And that being said, there are rare circumstances where somebody can go from zero to possessed fairly quickly, but you're talking about circumstances that are very intensely negative, occult situations where it would be very obvious that you're doing something incredibly reckless and dangerous. Your gut would be screaming, you know, your intuition would be screaming, there's something wrong here, I need to stop. So, you know, this is not something people need to fear that, you know, they'll watch a movie and become possessed or something. It's a very serious matter that God only allows when we really embrace it through our free will.
Possession by ghosts, does that ever take place, or is it only the demonic realm that has the ability to possess people?
You know, that's a very interesting question, Dave, and it's something that I don't think we have absolute clarity on, and here's the reason. In some historical cases, and the one that people can look up, there's a pamphlet that you can get. It's called Begone Satan with an Explanation Point. And the church published this, I believe it was in the 30s or 40s, and it was about an epic exorcism case that had gone on at that time. And this is just one example of this. And in that case, while they were casting the demons out and dealing with them, you know, some of the things we ask are, you know, well, who are you? How did you get in here? All right, when are you leaving? Well, some of them, as they were going through, the one spirit came forward and said, well, I'm her father, and I'm here because I'm damned, and the devil put me in here with the other demons to see the fruits of what I did to her and the sins that I did to her as part of my hell. And then that human spirit was cast out like the other demons were. So we see some evidence that once a soul is damned, because it's now basically the property of the devil, he can use it the way he wishes. And that opens up a lot of interesting questions. You know, if the devil gets rights to a house, might he have human souls there that are damned souls because it would be particularly effective for messing with the people that are there at the time or for whatever reason? So basically what I'm saying is it could happen. I don't think that the human souls would be souls in purgatory or holy souls doing that, but I think it's possible that the damned souls could.
Wow, now that definitely opens up a whole new perspective.
Yep.
You know, frightening even more so to me than just the demonic realm that the people in our lives, it may influence it. And it makes it almost sense, right? I mean, we create our own hell. Our hell may be to relive the lives or be a part of the lives of the people that we hurt and do damage to throughout our life. That certainly makes you pause for the cause and rethink and reconsider the way you treat people. Very frightening. When you look at cases of hauntings, and I know that earlier this year I hosted Bob Cranmer on Coast to Coast AM with his book, The Demon of Brownsville Road, mm-hmm. A Pittsburgh Family's Battle with Evil in Their Home. And I know that you were one of the first investigators to deal with this case. Now, do you believe that this was kind of a myriad of ghosts and demonic, or do you believe that it was demons taking on ghostly forms and doing these things to trick and play games with the human participants?
In that case, I think it's likely that it was all demons and they were just taking human form when it was convenient, or that would be the most effective way to scare or mess with somebody at the time. And I say that because, you know, so much of that case was typical of a demonic infestation. You know, it's possible that a damned soul could have been involved, but the overwhelming majority of the events in that case were very typically of, you know, demonic cases, just very ugly and nasty. There was a number of things in that case that related to some of the horrible events that people did in that home, But I don't think, to my mind at least, I don't think there was clear evidence that there was damned human souls showing up.
Do you believe that in a case like Amityville or Bronzeville, where there were tragedies that befell that area, that that can in fact scar or taint an environment, which makes it easier for demons to affect it?
No, I don't think that's the way to think about it, Dave. I think that the events that are horrible that went on that happened there, if people will allow me to frame it in terms of sin, you know, and doing evil as a sin, when we sin, we are basically saying to the demons that are tempting us, like, okay, I'm going to side with you in this moment, and I'm going to go along with the destructive and selfish choice here. Well, when I do that over and over, I'm kind of slowly choosing sides. And if I have authority over the home and I make those choices to side with the bad side, you know, implicitly over time, I'm giving them more and more rights to the home, because I'm saying, like, this is a place that celebrates you guys. This is a place that where we do the things you want us to do. And so over time, I'm giving them more and more rights to be there. I'm basically marking it as their territory through my actions. Now, the extreme version of that, you know, people do, you know, black magic and other stuff. But I think with really nasty sin, murders, suicide, various extreme actions can implicitly over time give them the rights to be there. So it's not so much like a wound or a stain, but it's the action of the free will that gives them the rights to be present. And once they get rights to be present, either in a life or in a building or in a body, they don't give them up until they're forced to.
Now, that specific case with Bob Cranmer and the Demon of Brownsville Road, was that one of the first cases that you saw an actual manifestation of demonic energy?
Yes. Yeah. It was one of the first cases I ever worked on. And thinking back, it was the first time that I saw black shadows sliding and moving around on the floors and walls. Also, where I experienced packets of air that had horrible odor that walked around like a person would. And it was supernatural. Other people smelled it also. That was the first case where early on during the tour of the house, when I first got there, the entire house smelled with a scent, filled with the scent of roses that everybody smelled. And it lasted 2 or 3 minutes, and suddenly it was gone, and there was no source of it, you know, and that was an encouraging sign. Yeah, Dave, that was the first real heavy case where I experienced a number of things.
Now, I know that in one of the talks that I saw a number of years ago when I first had the chance to meet you, there was a photograph of this black mass that appeared almost cloud-like to be moving from one mirror or coming out of a mirror. What can you tell us about that? Is that how most people would see a manifestation of evil? I hate to use the word demonic all the time, but would that be something that might be an indication that there's something very dark in your home?
It's possible. The thing about the black shadows, you want to be careful, is the way the eye works. It's worth taking a minute to talk about this. If you're seeing things just out of the corner of your eye, you want to be cautious about reading too much into that, because at the edge of our vision, you know, when we're looking straight ahead, we have color vision, it's detailed, and at the edge of our vision, off to the left or the right, while you're still staring straight ahead, you actually really only have black and white vision. There's only rods there, not the cones that do the color. And your brain, if you think about it, if you hold your hand in front of you and you see the five fingers, keep looking straight ahead and move your hand to the left. Well, you can still see your hand, but you can't count the fingers anymore. And that's because you don't have sharp vision over there. And as you go out further to the edge of your vision, you have black and white vision, and it's very limited, but you can kind of see things there. Well, your brain fills in the gaps in between things, and sometimes it doesn't do that perfectly with your vision. And so people will say, I saw a black shadow out of the corner of my eye. I turned to look at it, and it was gone. Well, that can be just an artifact of the way the vision system is not perfect. So that's just something to say to stop some of the fear out there. Now, that being said, Dave, when demons are not pretending to be something else, which they usually do, they usually pretend to be whatever is going to be whatever's going to disarm you and make you think it's something to interact with, they're going to pretend to be that. But if they're not pretending to be anything else, they generally appear like a black smoke that doesn't dissipate. It's not subtle. You can't see through it. It's mostly a solid smoke that moves and rolls. Sometimes it's the size of a mouse. Sometimes it's the size of a dog or a cat. Then there's a four-foot walker version that seems humanoid. It's black shadow, but it walks kind of like a small person. I've seen a little bit taller than me, man size, which would be close to what our caller from the last hour saw in terms of this hooded, robed figure. I've seen those. Then there's probably bigger than that, though I've not seen anything bigger. Now, and then they can be in the more just smoky form, where it's not really walking, it's just kind of moving through a room. If you're seeing that dead on, meaning you're looking straight at it, and it has no natural explanation that you can debunk, and particularly if it has a horrible odor, is more of the clue. Because them showing up as the black smoke is very rare. They usually hide. And but if it has a really bad odor, and it has no source, and it moves, and it leaves no lingering behind it, that's more of a clue that it's probably an evil spirit.
When you witnessed this in Cranmer's case, with this, and did you see it physically with the eye traversing, or were you only picking it up in photographic form?
Oh, no, I was looking straight at it. Yeah.
Does it seem to take notice of you as well, or was it just moving about doing whatever it was going to do?
Well, in that moment, I was in a room with somebody discussing the situation and the case, and it seemed like they were coming and listening and almost listening in. And now, years later, I know that they do that. They're very interested in who's trying to intervene or interfere with what they're doing. And so as you're trying to figure things out, they will hang out nearby and listen in and watch because they want to keep tabs on what you're doing. So I think that's what was going on.
Well, you've got a background in psychology. This was your first real case, and especially one dealing with demonic forces. How did you wrap your head around it? Were you even questioning what the experience was for yourself?
Sure. And that's why, you know, in those moments, it's really good to be with other people and say, okay, instead of saying, do you see the shadow over there, which is a leading question, and if somebody's suggestible and in a dim room, they're going to imagine they see a shadow, right? The question is, are you seeing anything, and then what are you seeing? And then, you know, keep watching it and see if it corroborates with other people's experience. And so those are the kind of things in those moments that I did, and other people were having the exact same experience. When the packet of this horrible odor was moving through the house, that you could follow it and find out where it was by the smell, everybody else was experiencing it also. And so, you know, as more of a psych and a scientist perspective, you want to verify it with other people and then ideally with equipment also. Now, years later, I don't worry so much about that. I more verify it just with other people. I'm not worried about recording things. But yeah, basically, you know, it was pretty mind-blowing, to be honest. I was interested in finding out what was going on with situations like this, and I was thinking more as a brain researcher. That's the work I was involved in, was EEG research at the time. And when I started seeing this stuff, and other people were too, and then you could smell it, and there was manifestations, and I got scratched at that case, and, you know, it made me realize this is very serious, and this is actually a spiritual phenomenon. It really has nothing to do with paranormal investigating. And that was the case where I said, okay, I need to make a hard left turn here and go down the road of the spiritual approach.
ReligiousDemonology.com, that's the website that you can check out and find more information about our guest, Adam Bly. You can direct emails there. You can check out the multiple resources that he has posted on that site. You can also check out his book, Possession, Exorcism, and Hauntings. We have links to that and to his website at Coast to Coast AM. We're going to continue talking about the demonic realm, some of the encounters that Adam has had personally, what it means, and how do we protect ourselves and assure that this won't happen to us. And we'll be taking your calls at the top of next hour. You're listening to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. Thank you so much for joining me this evening. I'll be back with you next Friday night, filling in for George Norrie. Next Friday, The Haunting of the Sally House, one of the most well-documented and most witnessed hauntings in America. We'll talk about that case with the Pickmans, Deborah and Tony Pickman, who experienced it and continue to experience the aftermath of that haunting. It's a chilling tale. Make sure you tune in with us, and then we'll open up phone lines for the next 2 hours of the show as well and take your calls, your opinions, your thoughts. You get a chance to shine with me on next Friday night. I hope you'll check that out. And if you like the strange and unusual, please join me Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight, as I host Darkness Radio. It's a show that takes a look at the supernatural, the paranormal, monsters, myths, legends, true crime, and so much more. You can find information about my show at darknessradio.com. We stream the show live from our website through an iHeartRadio application, and then keep tuned right in because George Norrie and Coast to Coast continues your journey into the strange every night of the week after Darkness Radio wraps up. We'd love for you to check it out. And we have a live chat room going right now. So if you'd like to come in and be a part of the live chat room along with other like-minded individuals fascinated by fringe topics, then please feel free to join us. You can email your questions, thoughts, concerns, stories right to me at dave@darknessradio.com. We will do our best to work those in throughout the show. We're opening up the phone lines at the top of next hour. If you believe you've had a demonic encounter, if you have questions for our guest regarding dark forces and the demonic, that'll be your time to chime in with us. We'll be back. We've got more Adam Bly and more cases of exorcism, oppression, and demons right here on Coast to Coast AM. Adam Bly, our guest this evening on Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Adam, let's talk a little bit about cases of possession and oppression. There is a certain formula that takes place. As you said, it's very rare that somebody just becomes possessed. How does it occur? Do they start to try to break you down if they can't get to you? Do they attack family members? How does that kind of progression happen?
Well, basically they'll work their way into your life kind of like a criminal or a con artist might. So whatever the opening is, they'll take advantage of that to try to get close to you figuratively in terms of basically a relationship. So for example, not overly picking on paranormal investigating, but let's say somebody goes to a place where really horrible things happen and there's manifestations there, and they go in and they say, whatever's here, you know, I want you to talk to me and interact with me. And so they basically, through free will, give that thing rights to interact with them and talk with them. So it will then pretend to be whatever that person wants to hear, or what that person's expecting, or what's going to excite that person. And so then they say, oh, that's interesting. So do more. You know, I want you to do this now. And then it performs for them. And it's basically playing along in the beginning until the person, over time, gives more and more rights for the interaction. And then it may move on to something, like to take a real example that I saw happen. Somebody was messing with psychomotor spirit communication, and that means allowing a spirit to move part of your body. So for instance, your hand, maybe with automatic writing or a pendulum or moving a glass on the table to point at things. And by doing that, you've given it permission to manipulate your body and your muscles in your body. And so this may lead to it then doing that more when you're not asking for it. And then slowly over time, it may say, well, we don't need to use the pendulum anymore. Just give me permission and I'll talk directly into your mind. And if the person thinks it's something positive, they may give permission for that. And now it's moved on to a different level of oppression. And then at some point, Dave, it knows that it has so much rights to you, you can no longer back out on your own. And at that point, it'll start turning on the person. It'll start saying, well, I'm not going to answer your questions anymore. You're going to do what I say. And I don't like when you do this, so I'm going to punish you when you disobey me. And then it starts becoming an abusive relationship. And then the extreme version of that is at some point it'll say, well, all this torture can end if you just let us completely have you. We won't hurt you anymore. And so the person may be broken down to the point over weeks or months or years that they're in such despair that they say, okay, I just want the pain to stop, and then they give in to full possession. So basically, it's a process that, you know, it's not like it's this or this. It slowly grades into things. Imagine like drug addiction or alcohol addiction. You know, it starts with a little bit of experimentation. The relationship deepens. You start seeing signs that it's affecting your life. And at some point, you hit rock bottom, you know, and it really, you lose your job or something extreme happens. There's kind of analogies there.
We have an email from Aaron. He says, hi, Dave, I have a question about angels and demons together for your guest as we tie last 2 hours into this hour and the future of the show here. If we all have guardian angels, what are they doing during a demonic possession? Aaron from Denver asks that question.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, God doesn't force himself on us. So demonic possession only happens when a person, through their free will, or if their parent did this to them when they're a child, but through somebody's free will who has authority, gives permission to the demon to take over that body. And so it's not that the possession's happening and God doesn't want that and the angel can't overcome the demon. It's not like that. The angel does not force us against our free will. So it's us as the humans with authority over our own bodies, through accepting that, that the angel has to step back and honor our choice. Okay?
All right. I think it's important, too, and I know that you've briefly touched on this with me in conversation in the past, but we talked earlier, is there anybody that is automatically protected from this? What was kind of chilling to me was that you told me that you've encountered nuns and priests and religious leaders that have been infected and influenced by the devil, or not maybe not the devil, but in demonic possession or oppression. How does that happen to somebody that's in a secular mode like that and is giving their life over to God? You would think they have the biggest wall of defense around them.
Well, again, Dave, the devil will trick us into giving in enough, and then he'll try to manipulate us into saying yes. So no matter who we are, where we're at in life, whether we're serving God and we've taken vows or whatever it is, we're still human, and we can still sin, of course, and we can be weak, and we can say yes to things we shouldn't say yes to. And if that includes the occult and leading down the road towards a demonic relationship as a human, if we choose those things, those choices are still binding. So really, you know, while we're on this earth, we always have the free will. We can choose good and we can choose evil.
And it can affect everyone. Now, is it easy to say, you hear about religious leaders, and not just in the Catholic Church or Christianity, but religious leaders worldwide that abuse their power. Do you believe that it is the influence of the devil that is having the effect on these, or is it just because as humans we are weak and flawed and do stupid things?
Well, I think it's both. I think in a lot of cases it's just human evil and human stupidity. And I say that because, you know, in working in the prisons with a lot of different types of criminals of all types, you know, murderers, sex offenders, thieves, drug dealers, serial killers, whatever it is, over the years in interacting with them and doing therapy with them and evaluating them, it became very clear that most bad choices come out of the way we were raised and the experiences that we had, which is why it's so important that we raise our children well and we give them love and attention and support. So, you know, I think the spiritual, yes, they tempt us, but I don't think we can kind of have a cop-out and lose a sense of responsibility for how we treat each other, how we treat our children, and our own choices. We really, I think that's where the bulk of it is. Now, you know, that being said,
and that's one of the problems I've seen, and I don't mean to interrupt, but that's why I wanted to bring that point up, is that's one of the problems I've seen with the advent of the popularity of the paranormal. People doing and acting stupidly, and then just blaming it on the effect of the paranormal on them. It's not just the fact that they made a stupid choice, and it had nothing to do with the devil. It had nothing to do with the ghost of old Uncle Joe in the house. It was the fact that this person did something dumb. You know, I think it's important that people remember we have to remain responsible for these actions as well. And I just fear that it is an easy cop-out for people. Do you get called into exorcism cases where you find out that it truly is and has absolutely nothing to do with the demonic realm at all? It's just somebody looking to pawn off their bad activity on an outside force?
Well, usually with the exorcisms, by the time it gets to the point of an exorcism, it's been so well investigated that it's been ruled out that it's just mental illness or medical. That being said, Dave, I have seen cases where people have tried to use the paranormal as a cover for their criminal activity. There was a case where a man was abusing some of the children in the family, and he was trying to convince everybody and getting them to blame it on the ghosts in the house. And, you know, this was a particularly heinous example of somebody trying to distract and get away with real criminal activity by blaming it on spirits. And that's kind of a different thing than what you're saying. But yes, we do need to own responsibility. Even the people that are possessed, even the people that have these deep relationships with the demons still have free will. It can be hard for them, and there can be moments where the demons take over, and then they're not responsible for what they're doing because the demon's using the body at that time. But even in possession states, that's rare outside of the exorcisms that the demon takes completely over, because that's usually in response to the spiritual pressure of what's going on. So yeah, Dave, I agree. It's you know, basically, we bring ourselves to these situations, right? So if somebody's paranormal investigating or if somebody's getting involved in demonic issues, we bring ourselves to that situation. And so it's not just the phenomenon, but it's also the personality of that person. And that's why we're so careful about, you know, what people are involved in these more serious demonic cases.
Adam, is there a side effect to being Adam Bly? Do people around you, are they influenced? It might not be as strong or as convicted in their religious beliefs. I would think that if they can't get to you, targeting your friends and loved ones would be the way that dark forces would make their presence known.
Sure. And you know, I've said this before. The first time I was put on the phone with an exorcist who in the years later we've become very close friends and worked together a lot. But the first time I was put on the phone with an exorcist, literally, it wasn't even hello or who are you and, you know, greetings. It was, do you have a wife? No. Do you have children? No. Do you have any pets? No. Okay, well, I guess you can come over and we'll talk. And, like, that was the first conversation I had. Because if they can't get at us, they will go after anybody that's vulnerable. It's not that they can just hurt other people near us just because they want to, but if there's a vulnerability there, they will really go after them. And the example I've given in the past, you know, my father just passed on, but he was a number of years ago when I was getting more involved in this seriously, he was very vulnerable because he had drifted away from spirituality, not spirituality, but from God and religion quite a bit. And this was about 10 years ago at this point, but he was thrown down the stairs in his house so hard that he didn't even touch the stairs, and he broke his neck. Took him 2 years to recover. Thank God he lived and he wasn't paralyzed. But it was a very serious thing. And when we talked about it and he described it, you know, he woke up or came to standing at the top of the steps, and the next thing he was in the air. Nobody else was home with him. He was alone. So for me, that was a very sobering moment because I had been warned about this, and I didn't, you know, I didn't understand that vulnerability was there for him. And it's a very scary thing to have your father harmed in that way. Now, the good fruit that came from that, through that experience, he took his spiritual life very seriously. He got himself squared away completely. He was in a very good place spiritually recently when he did die early. So you know, good fruit came out of it. But at the same time, Dave, like, yeah, I basically, you know, that's one of the things I think about, and I kind of have to keep my distance.
When you're facing these type of things, we hear, and I've seen a lot of people in the field that have worked in exorcisms and dealing with the demonic realm, and it doesn't seem like their lifespan is always very long. Is that because there is a physical wear when you do the work that you're doing in this field, Adam?
Well, you know, I think that's kind of an idea that Father Malachi Martin first kind of put out in his book, Hostage to the Devil, which is a great book for understanding what cases kind of look like and how they evolve. But in that, he talked about how the exorcists, you know, really take a toll, and that they can die early in that. But really, most of the guys we have in Rome that are the most experienced in the world, they're very old, and they've been doing this 40, 50 years. They're joyful, you know, they're extremely elderly, but they're still active and strong. So, you know, I don't really believe that. I have more trust and love in God than I have fear of the devil. And, you know, yes, there's a price to be paid for doing this. You do have to give some things up in your life. And yes, it's dangerous. You know, if you were doing this improperly, if you didn't have good training and formation and good spiritual backup, then I would say, Dave, yeah, there'd be a danger that you could get harmed, you could have some mental illness, or you could end up having a demonic problem yourself. This is not something you should enter casually.
Which leads me to a question from one of our listeners. Jim writes in and he says, what would he recommend, Adam, on how to become an exorcist or dealing with this?
Well, you know, an exorcist, at least in the Catholic system, is only a priest with permission from their bishop to do this work. And generally, they have a few years of training, plus they're mentored during a number of cases before they ever do stuff on their own. And so basically, to become an exorcist, you would have to be a priest first. And then, if you're the kind of person that comes and knocks on the bishop's door and says, I want to be an exorcist, that's exactly the person we don't allow to become an exorcist. Because if you're entering this for any selfish desire, wanting a thrill, wanting to see stuff, whatever, wanting to exploit it for fame or whatever it is, you're vulnerable because you're not doing it out of love and charity for somebody else. And so that's the person that we try to protect from getting involved.
Right. This isn't the extreme sports of the paranormal to become a demonologist or an exorcist. This isn't cool and you don't have street cred from doing this. This is a calling that's given to you, and you're usually given the gift of, is it discernment? Is that the correct terminology?
Sometimes discernment is kind of information from God to help you unravel cases and deal with cases. But usually what we see, Dave, the two things that you're typically given is protection and then a lack of fear. And it's not courage or bravado, but it's just literally a lack of fear. And God protects you from that, because when you actually encounter demons full on in bodies and whatnot, it is natural to be afraid of that. It's a very threatening situation. And so God protects us spiritually from the demons messing with us, unless we open the door to that. And then we're in a lot of trouble because they have committee meetings downstairs and they don't like us very much. But, you know, it's that lack of fear is the main thing. The discernment, some people get that, not everybody. Some people, their disposition is such that it wouldn't be good for them to have that discernment. And actually, a lot of exorcists don't. Because they need to focus on the fight, the actual battle of doing the exorcism, and other people around them will have the discernment. And then some exorcists do. Most of us can tell if a demon's in a person, at least that much. I'm not an exorcist, of course, I'm a lay person, but I'm involved. So, but other people, they have more discernment than that.
Adam Bly, our guest this evening. We're opening up phone lines in the next hour. If you've had an experience with something you believe to be a dark force, if you have questions for our guests, this is the time to call in and be a part of the show with us. ReligiousDemonology.com, that's the website to check out. Stay tuned. More of the best in overnight talk radio continues. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.